So again, let's do a quick review of what we took up last week. So last week, before we got into verses 10 to 20, and the heart of it, which is 13, we first zoomed out, first looked at the greater context, the larger context of chapter 4, which last week I said was the unity in love, in serving together to advance the gospel. That's Paul's main goal here, is to continue to encourage the Philippians to unity and love, and to continue to serve together to advance the gospel. Then we zoomed in a little bit into the context of verses 10 to 20. And I said that the title of it in the ESV, which is God's provision, is mainly what the 10 to 20 is about. It's that context. It's the provision of God, both to the ones who give and the ones who will receive. And I said that that provision is not mainly just material, but even in contentment. It takes contentment to give, and it takes, obviously, contentment to receive these gifts in the right way. So in verses 10 to 20, that's what it's talking about. It's God's provision for both the giver and the receiver. Namely, in this case, the givers were the Philippians, and the receiver was the Apostle Paul. But again, in both cases, God is the ultimate provider. Not just the material things, but also the contentment that both need in order to enable the Philippians to be cheerful givers and for Paul to be a grateful and joyful receiver. After seeing that context, we zoomed in again. This time in order to truly understand what is at the heart of this chunk of verses. And again, it is verse 13. I know you're at home and this sounds silly, but can you just recite verse 13 for me? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I don't know who did it at home, but for you who did, God will bless you more. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, everybody knows this verse, Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through God, through Him who strengthens me. Especially, you know, you see these on athletes. They're tattooed on their chest, or, you know, they write it on their faces. Sadly for a lot of people, this verse is misunderstood, taken out of context. And I said that last week, that this verse, Philippians 4:13, including the last half of verse 10 and verses 11 and 12, is really Paul clarifying his main point in the first part of verse 10. Because if you read the first part of verse 10 again, some may take it the wrong way. Some may misunderstood what Paul was trying to say here. Because verse 10 seems to be a spontaneous statement by Paul because of the joy that he had, that the Philippians continued their partnership with him. How? By sending him help, or sending him some financial help through Epaphroditus, right? So in Paul's mind, you know, after he wrote, or as he was writing verse 10, you know, some may read this verse and misunderstand what he's trying to say. Because of this statement in the first part of verse 10 that says, "Now at last your care for me has flourished again," which is the New King James translation of verse 10. So when you read that, and this is, again, Paul's thinking is that some may read this and think that the Philippians at one point stopped caring for Paul because of that phrase, "Now what last?" Some might think that, oh, so there was a point where the Philippians stopped caring for Paul. Or some may read that and think that, you know, the only reason that Paul's rejoicing was because all he wants is the money that the Philippians are sending him. That's why he took the last part of verse 10 and verses 11, 12 to clarify himself so that there would be no misunderstanding. So if you read the last part of verse 10, "You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity." So this is Paul's clarification for those who read the first part and thought that the Philippians stopped caring for Paul, right? He clarified, you know, that misunderstanding or that misreading of it in the last part of verse 10, because that's, you know, if you read the first part of verse 10 and say, yeah, all the Philippians stopped caring for Paul because they just, you know, recently just resumed caring for him again, That's not what Paul was trying to say. In fact, Paul points out in the last part of verse 10 that the Philippians were really cheerful givers. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to continue in their partnership with Paul through their giving. Or we can say also that they were itching to give and support Paul for the longest time, but had no opportunity. And by that, when I say that they had no opportunity, I take that to mean that they had no one to bring their gifts to Paul. Because remember, Paul is about 1,300 kilometers away from the Philippians at this time. And to do that in that day, to bring somebody a gift, or to bring somebody, or to send somebody something, it's not like today where you can just, you know, drop it in a mailbox and it'll be there like in 2 days or in a day. No, somebody had to go and travel, sometimes most of the time by foot, to get this gift or to get this help over to the person that you're trying to send it to. And, you know, a lot of people in those days died doing that. So it's a very risky thing to do. But when Epaphroditus came and volunteered to be that guy, he gave the Philippians the opportunity once again. And the Philippians, instead of saying, ah, you know what, we haven't sent in a while, maybe he's okay anyway, so let's not send. No, that's not what the Philippians did. When they got the opportunity, they gave. They gave and sent the gift through Epaphroditus. Now, in our text this morning, Paul is clarifying once again, clarifying his statement at the first part of verse 10. For anybody who would read this first part of verse 10 and think that all Paul's reason for rejoicing was solely because of the money he was receiving from the Philippians. So that's not the reason why Paul was rejoicing in the first part of verse 10. And Paul is using verses 11 and 12 to clarify that, to prove that that's not true. Okay, so let's look at Philippians verse 11, just the first part of verse 11. Paul starts off with a defense again of what he said, or not a defense, but his clarification of what he said in the first part of verse 10 by saying, not that I am speaking of being in need. That's the first part of verse 11. Not that I'm speaking of being in need. First thing that Paul says to clarify what he said in the first part of verse 10 is that, not that I'm speaking of being in need. Or Paul is saying, if I was to rephrase that verse, Paul is saying, I'm not rejoicing because I was needy and you provided for my needs. That's not why I'm rejoicing. I'm not rejoicing because you're providing for my needs. Or that I was needy. So you read that, you read Philippians 4:11a, and obviously that's not true. Obviously Paul had needs. But again, what he's trying to do here is to clarify the doubt for the doubters that he is not just after the money, but something even more. And we'll get to that as we go through the verses leading up to verse 20. And then here in 11a, he emphasizes that by saying, I don't really need your money. But I mean, if you think about it, Paul has been... when he said that I don't really need the money, it's kind of true, it's kind of not true. But if you think about it, there's a truth to that because the Philippians did stop giving for a period of time. And in that period of time, Paul has been able to continue ministry, even when the Philippians weren't able to send him money, right? So question is, who provided for Paul during then? Someone obviously did, right? Otherwise, he wouldn't have the resources to continue. So even though the Philippians stopped giving, somebody was providing for Paul. So when you think about it that way, again, when he said in Philippians 4:11a, not that I'm speaking of being in need, or, I don't really need your help, or I don't really need your money, that's kind of false, right? Because yeah, he did have needs, and somebody did provide for those needs. So again, why did he say, not that I'm speaking of being in need? Paul takes the rest of verse 11. all the way to verse 13 to clarify what he meant by that phrase. So if you read the rest of 4:11, it says this. Not that I'm speaking of being in need, for, and again, this is his reasoning, this is his argument for saying, I don't really need your money, I really have no needs, because I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. Right? So, it's not like he doesn't need anything, but even though the Philippians didn't send, and even though whoever was providing for him wasn't giving as much as the Philippians, Paul's saying, I'm not really in need in that sense because I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. So Paul says that he's not rejoicing because he just received money from the Philippians, because he doesn't really need their money per se. And his main reason for saying that is that even though in reality he does need financial help, his main reason for saying that he doesn't really need their help or doesn't really need their money is because he has learned in any situation to be content. So two key words there, right? Learned and content. Two key words in verse 11 that I want us to focus on. Learned and content. So what does that say about biblical contentment? That's our topic for this morning. I'm going to spend most of our time, all of our time that's left, going through that. So what does that say about biblical contentment? Again, the key words are learned and content. So first, let's define contentment. Let's define it first in our dictionary, like from the dictionary, right? In the dictionary, if you look it up on your internet, like if you Google it, contentment is a state of happiness or satisfaction. Okay, that's what it means to be content in the dictionary. You're in a state of happiness, I would say constant happiness, or satisfaction, you're content. Or contentment in Wiki says this, Wiki defines contentment as an emotional state of satisfaction that can be seen as a mental state, maybe drawn from being at ease in one situation, body and mind. So if you're at ease in your situation, you are content. Now, let's look at what the Bible says about contentment, and let's compare it to that definition that we got from the dictionary. So, the original Greek word used here for contentment in Philippians 4 is the word autarkes. Autarkes. A-U-T-A-R-K-E-S. Autarkes. Which literally means to be self-sufficient or to be independent. What is that? What does self-sufficiency or independence have to do with contentment? Right? And there's, if you compare that to the dictionary meaning, there's a huge difference, right? Contentment in the dictionary is a state of mind. It's a state of being, you know, happy and being satisfied because of the ease that you are experiencing in your environment. Meanwhile, in the Bible, the word that Paul used here doesn't talk about anything like that. He talks about self-sufficiency and independence. Huge difference in definition, right? If you look at it even closer, the other difference between biblical contentment and the way we in our society define contentment today is that word, the other key word that we have. What's the other key word that we are supposed to keep our minds keep thinking about? Is the word learned, right? Paul learned what it was to be content. This is why he can say to the Philippians, I don't really need your money because in any situation, I learned how to be content. That's the other difference between biblical contentment and the way we define contentment in our society. So again, on one hand, we see contentment the way our society defines it, as an emotional, mental state, being at ease in one situation, body and mind. And then on the other hand, the biblical, that Paul uses, the biblical contentment that Paul is talking about here is something that is learned. Something that is learned. Learning to be self-sufficient. That's what it says, right? Learn to be self-sufficient or independent. Now, when you look at those two meanings, now we see why a lot of people misunderstand and misuse this word contentment, especially in the Christian circles, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to apply worldly society's definition of contentment into Scripture. So when you look at that, you know, when Paul says, I've learned to be content, if you don't dig enough to look at it in context and even the words that were used, the original words that were used, we're going to look at contentment as always being a positive situation, always being in a positive atmosphere, right? But as we're going to see in the next verse, that's definitely not true. The way Paul defines contentment. Look at verse 12. Verse 12 says, I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned this, the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. So when Paul says that he has learned how to be content in any situation, he's not always referring to a positive situation, right? He lists for us here in verse 12 three sets of situations that contains both negative and positive situations, right? Being brought low and learning how to, or being in abundance, right? Negative, positive. Facing plenty or facing hunger, right? Positive, negative. Having abundance or being in need, right? Positive, negative. So in all those situations, Paul has learned to be content. He's learned to rejoice. If you go back to verse 10, right? He's learned to rejoice because he's content in any situation, positive or negative. So really, if we were to understand Paul's definition of contentment, we need to get a grip on what it means to be content, or we need to learn or know how it is to be in abundance or be brought low. And again, the key to this is in verse 12, in learning the secret. You see that in the last part of verse 12? I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger. Ultimately, we'll go back to that. What is that secret? But for now, what does Paul mean by being content? And not just being content in just a positive sense, but being content in any sense. And again, contentment points to rejoicing, being joyful, rejoicing in any situations. So that when we know this secret, or when we learn this secret, you're able to rejoice and be content in the ups and downs of life. That's why when you look at Paul's definition of contentment, you can't inject, you know, the dictionary's definition of contentment here. It's impossible, right? Because Paul is talking about positive and negative situations. Meanwhile, our society's definition of contentment is all about positive. It's all about abounding. It's all about having plenty. That's not true contentment when it comes to the Bible. Biblical contentment is about being joyful in any circumstance. And the sign of true biblical contentment is not in your outer situation, but it's in your inner joy and peace. And again, Paul says that this kind of contentment is learned. Okay? It's not a state of mind. It is not an emotion. This contentment is learned. In fact, Paul says that if you don't have true contentment or biblical contentment, this means that you don't know the secret, because being content is knowing or learning how to handle being brought low or how to handle abundance. Now, when we talk about that, learning how to be brought low and learning how to abound, you know, what does that mean? So learning the secret of facing plenty and facing hunger. What does that even mean? Especially in abundance. Why do you have to learn to be content in abundance? Shouldn't you already be content when you're abounding? Is that how society defines contentment? In abundance, in ease of environment, body and mind? So is that even possible? Are there people out there who don't know, who are still discontent in their abundance? Yes. Sadly, that there are people out there who are still discontent, they're still not content in abundance. Therefore, they don't know how to handle abundance properly, right? There are people out there who have no true biblical contentment and therefore do not know how to handle an abundance. For example, an abundance of money. Okay? Who here has an abundance of money? I'm broke. No, I'm not broke. We're all, if you live in Canada, you're pretty much rich compared to the majority of, you know, people who live in this world, okay? So, yes, we have an abundance here in North America, but for a lot of people, we don't know how to handle abundance. Why? Because of discontentment. According to an article on CNBC, lottery winners, okay, people who won the lottery, are more likely to go bankrupt within 3 to 5 years than the average American, okay, or I would say Canadian. So those of you who are still buying your lottery tickets, you want to go bankrupt quick? Win the lottery. That's what this article says, right? And according to another article, there are 4 reasons why lottery winners tend to lose everything, okay? Number one, they stop working, right? That's the first thing. Oh, I won the lottery. That's it. I'll stop. Or I'll quit my job. Stop working. And then they also do this. Number two, they give too much money away. Oh, I won the lottery. I'm going to make it rain on everybody. Woo-hoo. Right? Number three, they forget about taxes. Oh, no. Especially in the U.S., the lottery is taxed. Oh, no. I'm not getting $300 million. I'm only getting $50. Oh, no. Forgot about that. I shouldn't have made it rain on people. I shouldn't have quit my job, right? And last but not least, they go spend crazy. That's why a lot of people, especially, this is the States, but I'm thinking probably the same thing here. There's been news here about people winning the lottery and going bankrupt within a few years because they do these things. Why? Aren't they happy with winning the lottery? No, right? They're still not content. That's why they had to do all these other things. They spend like crazy. They, you know, they give away money, thinking that that's going to give them the joy that they're craving, that they're looking for. Meanwhile, it didn't or it doesn't. And again, this is a sign of discontentment because they don't know how to abound, right? They don't know how to abound when it comes to money. This shows that without true contentment, lottery winners end up spending all their winnings in pursuit of a happiness they thought they had when they won the lottery. Meanwhile, after winning, oh, I'm still not happy. So let me use my money now to find that happiness, and they can't find it. And again, it shows that even with that much money for some of these lottery winners, no one can buy happiness. Or I would say no one can buy contentment. And again, why is that? Because Paul says that contentment, biblical contentment, is learned or is knowing a secret. Okay, we're going to get to that again later. So that's one example, abundance in money, that people who have an abundance are still not content. What about abundance of health? People who don't have true biblical contentment do not know how to handle being healthy. What do I mean by healthy? I'm not talking about being fit like an athlete. I'm talking about healthy people are those who have all their limbs, okay, can hear, can speak, can see, can pretty much do everything that they want, right? These are healthy people. I'm not talking about you have to be fit, you have to be a certain shape or a certain, you know, aesthetics. No, if you can walk, talk, you know, use all your fingers, legs, you can see. Even if you have glasses, you can still see, you can hear. You're healthy. Who here is healthy? Raise your hand. Everybody should be, right? If you're that, right, you should be content, right? Biblically content. But for a lot of us, including myself, instead of being content or knowing how to handle abundance when it comes to health, we abuse our body. How? And again, this is all me. Not eating right, okay? Eating too much. Some smoke, some drink too much, not exercising, okay? Again, I'm going to start that again. Not getting enough sleep, okay? Staying up, watching whatever, or doing whatever. And I can keep going, but the point here is this. Having an abundance of health without true contentment, again, means that people who do that, we don't know how to abound because we don't have true biblical contentment. Not these people are not content in just being healthy. They also want to do and experience everything, most of which are not good for the body, right? So what happens? They end up abusing their health. So instead of having, you know, be happy with abundance of health, you end up ruining it because of a lack of contentment. Or, another example, and this is one of those bato-bato sa langit, tamay, huwag magagalit, okay? So, but if you do get mad with this illustration, just email me. Don't go talk to people about it. Oh, pastors, so this and this and that. You know, if you take this illustration the wrong way, just email me and we can have a conversation about it, okay? So another example of not knowing how to handle abundance, okay? Parents who are always complaining about having to take care of their own kids during this pandemic. I hear that in the news a lot. Oh no, you know, this is harder because I have to take care of my own children and I have to work and take care of my own children. It's so hard. And I get it. Listen, parenting is no easy task. It's hard, especially if you have young kids. But, you know, if you read your Bible, you know this, that you know that the Bible refers to your children as the precious fruit of the womb, right? As the heritage from the Lord, that children are a reward. Even Jesus, we were talking about this in Sunday school. Jesus use children as an illustration of those who will inherit or enter the kingdom of heaven. Right? So in essence, if you look at that, again, it's in Psalm 127. In essence, those of you who have kids, those of us who have kids, are in abundance. Right? We're rich with children, right? Compared to those who want to have kids but can't. There are a lot of couples there who want to have kids, but can't. Right? Those of us who have children, biological children, are rich with children. We are abundant when it comes to that sense. But what happens? Instead of rejoicing that we're able to, and we're gifted with not just one, some of us have multiple children, we complain. Instead of us rejoicing, thank you, Lord, for my kids, and thank you for this pandemic, because now I get to take care, spend time with my kids while doing my work. A lot of us complain. Right? And again, this shows a lack of knowing how to handle abundance, meaning what? Sign of discontentment. And this especially goes to those of you who have help at home. Like if you have somebody at home to help you take care of your kids, you shouldn't be complaining. There should be no reason to complain. You are more abundant than the single mothers or the moms who take care of their children on their own. So if you have somebody at home that's helping you take care of your kids and you're still complaining, wow. That shows just a lack of, again, knowledge of the secret thing that gives the heart contentment. Why? Because it shows you don't know how to handle your abundance. Can't you just be happy and that you get to take care of your children? And again, children are a gift from God. Children are a heritage from the Lord. So if you look at all these examples, the common denominator is, again, lack of joy in the abundance. Lack of joy in the abundance. Not knowing how to handle abundance is a sure sign of discontentment. And I'm talking about biblical discontentment. Just remember, right? Always put yourself in the shoes of those who don't have what you have in order for you to be grateful and thankful for what you have. Right? Think about it that way. Right? Think about it that way. On the other hand, when you look at those people who have, you know, who know the secret that Paul is talking about here and know biblical contentment, know how to handle their abundance, what do they do? So instead of complaining about their jobs, some people have jobs, but all you hear is about, oh, my job sucks, my job sucks, my job sucks. So instead of complaining about their jobs, people who are biblically content, they even work harder because they're so thankful for their job. They find joy in doing what they do because they know that that job is really a provision from God, right? Instead of complaining about it, they are, these people work harder. Those people have money, right? Instead of spending it to find the joy that's lacking in their lives, it's like the lottery winners I said earlier. People who have money and are content know how to give and give with a cheerful heart, like the Philippians. And I'm going to get to that later on. Like that, this is how God provides for his people. Through other people in giving them both contentment to give and receive. That's why the title of the series is A Cycle of Contentment. And again, I'm trying not to get ahead of myself, but I got to say that, right? That's the cycle. Somebody, the people who give have to be content with what they have. Otherwise, they won't give. So if you have biblical contentment, it also frees you to give and give cheerfully. Those who are healthy and biblically content, what do? They take care of their bodies instead of abusing it. Parents who are biblically content train up their children in the way they should go instead of always finding a way to pass them off for someone else to train them. Okay. We are so thankful for the opportunity to be able to spend time with our kids. Instead of, can you take? Biblical contentment does that. Because we know that kids are a gift from God. So that's what it is when it comes to, contentment affecting how we handle our abundance. What about, handling how to be brought low, right? So how does contentment, so we saw how contentment and or discontentment may affect somebody who already is abounding. What about how does biblical contentment affect somebody who has been brought low? Paul said, I have learned to be content. I have learned the secret in facing plenty and hunger, abounding and being brought low, right? So what does that look like? How does contentment help and affect somebody who is brought low? Now, as a parent, I'm going to use kids again as an example. As a parent, my lowest point, and I'm thinking of this, and I'm thinking, that's probably the worst thing to happen to a parent. The worst thing to happen to a parent is if my children would pass away before me. Right? That's every parent's worst nightmare. If it's your kid dies before you. And this is where Paul's definition of contentment really hits home, right? Paul says that he knows how to be brought low. He knows the secret of facing hunger and need, right? What does that look like practically? How does a biblically content person handle being brought low. And again, in this case, I'm going to use the example of a parent losing their child, which I think is the lowest point for any parent. I'm going to use Tim Challies as an example for this point. If you don't know who Tim Challies is, Tim Challies is a popular blogger. He's an author and book reviewer and also a pastor. He pastors Grace Fellowship Church here in Toronto. A few months ago, during the first lockdown, Tim's son, who was studying in the States to become a pastor, suddenly passed away. Okay, he just received the news that he was, he was brought to the emergency, and then a few hours later, Tim Challies' son passed away. I think he was 20 years old. He passed away. So I'm going to read to you an article that Tim wrote about his son's passing, which I think embodies what it means to know how to be brought low. Okay. This is somebody who is experiencing the lowest point in his life, but because of knowing the secret to contentment, this is how he approached it. This is how he handled the lowest point in his life. I'm going to read to you the letter. I think we're going to flash it for you as well. So it says here, Mr. Challies, we want to know that we have received Nick into our care. That's his son. Rest assured that he is in the very best hands. This message comes as a relief, for it means that Nick's long last lonely journey is complete. Even if he can't come home, he has at least arrived back in his own country, back in his own town. It is not as we hoped. It is not as we imagined. But it is as God willed. Have you chosen the clothes you'd like for him to wear? Question seems equal parts significant and ridiculous. How could it possibly matter what he wears in his casket? But on the other hand, how could we not clothe him in something smart, something dignified, something befitting his humanity? Well, we chose a handsome gray sweater, well-worn jeans, casual shoes. Rummaging through the basement, we find a bag to hold it all. We fold each piece of clothing carefully, a neat pile, one item after another. Once we have prepared him, how would you like to see him? We haven't seen him in 3 months, not since the start of the semester. Should we see him one last time? We ponder the idea for a few moments, but decided, no. We don't want to see him there. We don't want to see him like that. Not as our final memory. We have better memories, happier ones. We even have a photo of him in that very outfit, and in those photos, his eyes are open, his cheeks are bright, his fiance is on his arm, and he is joyful, satisfied, content. If all we can have is memories, we prefer to hold on to that one. The clothes sit by the door for a day or two, waiting for someone to pick them up. Now at last, the driver is on his way. Still, I can't shake the feeling that something is missing, that I've left something undone, incomplete. I go to my office and open the cupboard where I keep my writing paper, and I began writing Nick letters in the first days of his freshman year, bits of advice, assurances of love, words of encouragement. I wanted to be sure he'd never have reason to doubt my joy, my pride, my affection. He kept each one. I found them stored together in a little pouch in his dorm room desk. Perhaps then it would be fitting to write one more. In the back of the cupboard, I find a note card embossed with my name. Fitting, I pause for a moment to consider. Is there any good reason to write a letter that no one will ever read? Am I writing for him or for me? Does it even really matter? I think back to the words I had written him a year prior. Words of a father reassuring his son, rejoicing in his son. Now I write them a second time. I love you as much as any father can love a son. I'm as proud of you as any father can be proud of a son. I miss you as much as any father can miss a son. But something is still missing. But what? Words come to my mind, lyrics from an old hymn, forgotten to the most but precious to me. It's a hymn written from the perspective of a Christian who is spanning the briefest of moments between life and death. I sing it quietly to myself. I journey forth rejoicing from this dark veil of tears, to heavenly joy and freedom from earthly bonds and fears, where Christ our Lord shall gather all his redeemed again, his kingdom to inherit. Good night till then. The hymn continues with a second stanza. As this beloved saint draws his final breath, he offers tender assurance to his loved ones. Why thus so sadly weeping, beloved ones of my heart? The Lord is good and gracious, though now he bids us part. Then come words that suit both, the one departing and the one remaining. They are just right, perfect. I take up my pen and write words I imagine he is saying to me, even as I say them to him. Oft have you met in gladness, and we shall meet again. All sorrows left behind us, good night, till then. Love forever, Dad, I add. Then I fold the paper and place it tenderly in his pocket. I gently run my hand over his sweater, feeling it one last time. The closest I can come to feeling him one last time. Good night, my boy, I whisper. Good night, till then. When you read that and you get the gist of what he's trying to say, even in the deepest sorrows, a Christian who has learned how to be content, learned the secret of facing plenty, learned the secret of facing hunger, learned the secret of abounding, learned the secret of how to be brought low, a Christian like that knows how to handle being brought low. A Christian like that knows how to handle sorrow and still be able to rejoice at the lowest point of their life. That's what true contentment means. Right? True contentment is not just being content in the positives, not just being at ease with your environment. It's being able to rejoice no matter what the situation is, no matter how high you get or how low life brings you. True contentment is knowing how to handle both. Knowing how to abound, knowing how to be brought low. And again, it is rooted in knowing this secret. Knowing the secret. Where does it say that again? I know how to abound, verse 12, I know how to be brought low. And I know how to abound in any and every circumstance. I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance, and need. What is that secret, okay, that Paul has learned to have that kind of contentment, to know how to be brought low, to know how to abound? If you would like to know, come back next week for part 3 of this series as we take up the heart of this chunk of verses in verse 13. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Let me give you a hint. Okay, being content is not just staying there. Since I'm down, I'm just going to stay down. That's not true contentment. It's not to be happy with your situation. Okay? Why? There's an action involved, right? There's a learning and an action involved when it comes to true biblical contentment. Just look at the verse. I can do. Okay? I can do all things through him who strengthens me. That's where the secret lies. Okay? Want to learn it? Want to know it? Come back next week. Amen. Let's close with a word of prayer.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord lift his countenance upon you
and give you peace.
And give you peace.
Gracious.
The Lord be gracious.